Morning, everyone. I'm sitting in a chair today because I hurt my foot a couple of months ago and I can't sit on a cushion anymore. The last time I gave a talk, I confessed that I'm sometimes clumsy and I bump into things and I'm not always paying attention. And lo and behold, one dark morning I bumped into something in my house and broke a bone in my foot. So I didn't follow my own teaching very well. Today I'm going to talk to you about the sacred lotus. In Buddhism, the lotus flower, it's a symbol of Buddha or Buddhist enlightenment. And it's also sacred in Hinduism and many other spiritual traditions. Since earliest times, it's been associated with the spiritual life, because it produces beautiful, clean, and fragrant blossoms while growing in muddy places. The muddy water doesn't cling to it, so it represents a pure mind which is free of suffering. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha compared himself to a lotus, saying that the lotus flower rises unstained from the muddy water in which it grows, as he rises from this world free of defilements. In Buddhist art and literature, lotus blossoms represent the awakened mind and the Buddha, or awakening to our own Buddha nature and experiencing pure mind. In statues of Buddha, he's very often shown sitting on a stylized lotus blossom. Sometimes hard to figure out that what you're seeing is a lotus blossom, but it almost always is. And that indicates his enlightenment. The lotus also represents faith because believing that it's possible to rise above muddy water by following a spiritual path requires faith or trust in yourself, or in the practice, or in the teachings, or in a living teacher. So a couple of years ago, Taizoin, which is the temple in rural Japan where Katagiri Roshi began his priesthood, the temple was really decrepit and it was torn down and a new temple was built. And we received some photos of the dedication ceremony, and a couple of them really surprised me. And I have them here. You can look at them later if you want to. You can't see much out of them, right, if I hold them up. But what I saw were these two huge gilt golden lotus statues. And there were two of them, one on either side of a table that was in front of the altar. They were so tall that they towered over the heads of the priests that approached them during the ceremony. So they had a real wow factor. You know, our altars tend to be fairly simple, but when you look at pictures of Japan, there's a lot more going on. Seeing these shiny lotuses really captured my attention, and they touched my heart. I appreciated that something happened, something. When I saw the lotus, it aroused something, a feeling in my heart without actually engaging the part of my mind that uses words. And that's been kind of working on me. So recently I started studying the lotus, the actual plant, to learn more about it and look at it from a lot of different angles. I sort of was asking it, "Dear magnificent lotus, what are you showing me? What are you telling me about life and spiritual practice?" So what I found is that learning more about the lotus has deeply enriched my relationship with it. And I'm going to talk about that. But first, I want to tell you a little bit more about the lotus itself. It's one of the oldest and most primitive flowering plants in the world. It's called a living fossil. based on fossil evidence of it having existed in the Cretaceous period, going back up to 145 million years ago. All parts of it are edible, and it's been cultivated as a food crop for more than 7,000 years. It's an ingredient in traditional Chinese herbal medicine, and it's a phytoremediator that cleans the water in aquaculture ponds. Its scientific name is Nelumbo nucifera, and it's known as the sacred lotus. It grows profusely in ponds, lakes, and quiet waterways in Asia, often alongside water lilies, but much taller. There's a similar but smaller species called Nelumbo lutea, which is native to North America and grows here. And that's known as the American lotus. Like the statues at Taizhuin, the sacred lotus is a very large plant. It can grow up to 6.5 feet tall. Though how much of it you actually see depends on how deep the water that it's growing in is. The leaves are 3 feet in diameter, completely round with fluted edges, and the stem is located right in the center. That's a really big leaf. I tried to imagine 3 feet or demonstrate it, and I have really long arms. When I make a circle, sort of like a leaf, in Zazen, I measured that that's about 2 feet across. So the leaf is really big. The blossoms are 12 inches across, which is about the size of a dinner plate. And it has a large and very distinctive and probably, I would say, unique feature of a seed pod, which is about 4 inches across. And it grows right in the center of the blossom, and is visible when the blossom is open. And it looks like a shower head. I have a couple for show and tell. And I thought I'd pass them around so you can actually touch part of a lotus and kind of get a sense of the scale. This is the seed pod with some seeds still in it. And these came into my life in a flower arrangement. I got them a long time ago. And when I first saw them, I was sort of stunned by them, and I actually did not know what it was. I was so ignorant of what a lotus actually looks like that I didn't recognize it as a lotus. It gradually occurred to me, maybe that's a lotus. I've seen that there's a lot of photographic confusion between the lotus and water lilies. But seeing that distinctive pod in the center of the blossom is one of the ways you can distinguish a lotus, because the water lily doesn't have any structure like that in it. Another way to distinguish them is the leaves. Water lilies are huge. Some of them are huge, but they have a really deep notch that goes from the edge of the leaf into the center where the stem is. And the lotus doesn't have that. It's completely circular. Another difference is the height. Water lily leaves and blossoms form compact clusters that float on the surface. But lotus leaves and blossoms are mostly high above the water. And they're spread out. There's no cluster of lotuses. So you can be a little smarter now. When you see photos, you'll say, a lot of times you'll see a water lily where you think a lotus is meant to be. And you can say, okay, I know the difference now. So now to go a little deeper into what that plant can show us. As I said, knowing more about it botanically has deepened my relationship with it. And I want to share some of what I learned with you today and about how it's influenced me as I've come to know it better. And we're going to start with the mud, because that's where it grows. It's usual to think of mud as something dirty or bad. When your dog comes in and tracks mud all over your floor, that's bad for you, but maybe not for the dog, who had a lot of fun playing in that mud. So there's more than one way to think about mud. There's an incident in the recent novel Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. Has anybody read that one? Not too many. Well, there's a little bit of a spoiler alert, I guess, but it's something that happens early in the book, and I don't think it will trouble you too much. But the main character of that book is a 7-year-old girl who's been abandoned by her family. She's fending for herself and living alone in a shack on a North Carolina coastal estuary. And one day she steps on a rusty nail that damages her foot pretty badly. And she knows enough to know that she's at danger of developing what she calls lockjaw, which is tetanus. But she doesn't have anybody to help her. So recalling her mother's folkways, she soaks her foot in a salty, brackish slipstream. And when the tide goes out, she digs a hole in the mudflat and puts her foot in it. And then at home, she keeps her foot wrapped with muddy cloths. After a week of doing this every day, her wound started to heal, and she survived. Probably she survived because that dark mud was home to a vast and unseen living microbiome. It was vitally alive. Oh, they're back. Thanks. And had healing properties. The healing ability of that mud occurred within its darkness. We might associate darkness with the unseen because there's fear. We don't know what's there. Or we maybe despair because we can't see what to do or where to go. But in Buddhism, darkness often represents the original primordial or formless aspect of life. The other side of darkness then is daylight, the everyday world where we can see the form of things and make distinctions and judgments. These two aspects of life in Buddhism are sometimes called the absolute for the darkness and the relative for the light. In Taoist terms, darkness is yin, the still and receptive aspect of the life energy called qi, where light is the yang aspect, which is active and dynamic. David Hinton, the poet and translator of Chinese poetry, talks about the receptive yin dark as something creative. He has the term the generative tissue of Tao. In Buddhism, we say the womb of Buddha, or the ground of being. It's the cosmological ground that's the emptiness from which all things are born, and where everyday life emerges. I imagine that dark, unseen, muddy bottom of a lotus pond as still and receptive. It accepts everything that falls into it without making any discrimination of good or bad. It seems like Suzuki Roshi was talking about that kind of mud when he said, "Reality can be said to be the bed that is deep and soft enough to accept everything as it is." Suzuki said, "Zen may be said to be the practice of cultivating our mind to make it deep and open enough to accept the various seeds of ideas and thoughts as they are. When this kind of perfect acceptance takes place, everything will orient itself according to its own nature and the circumstances. We call this activity the great activity." I think the mud accepts everything and sorts it out based on the law of Dharma. It digests what it can and prepares life for growth according to the conditions it finds. The feeling or image that arouses in me is that unconditional acceptance and constant renewal is always going on at the muddy bottom of my life. Even if I can't see it, I can trust life to make use of the past and create new possibilities for my future. But I have to participate in this process by softening my ego and practicing humility. For us, it means seeing ourselves honestly, not clinging to what we think we are, and allowing what's unseen in the mud of our lives to help us to grow. Snuggled into that fertile ground of their lakes and ponds are the lotus seeds with the potential to create new plants. But first, they have to sprout. Lotus seeds are very patient. In China, some 1,300-year-old seeds were found in a dry lake bed. And when they were given the right conditions of temperature, light, and heat, they germinated just fine. So when the conditions are right, the potential life energy stored in the seed is aroused, and the primary root of the lotus breaks through the tough outer skin of the seed, and it starts growing down further into the mud. That new root anchors the plant, absorbs water and nutrients from the mud, and then sends a milky sap up to the first stem that forms. Later, as the plant grows, in order to store energy, the root develops starchy rhizomes or tubers that look like large potatoes. Over time, these develop into a chain that looks like a rope of sausages, with new leaf and blossom stems growing from the twist points. These roots, these tuber roots, survive and grow for many years. So in a lotus pond, much of the vegetation that you see may be from these buried rhizomes. So the root exists in the world of darkness, but it nurtures life in the world of light. You could think of the root as a place where two worlds are working together as one. There's a root like that in all of us. Katagiri Roshi says, "An indescribable fragrance comes forth from every pore of a human being who manifests the deep root of life with the human body. Buddhist practice is to make the root of your life strong. Continually, under all circumstances, we stand up in oneness and deal with ourselves and others from that place." That moment when the primary root begins pushing from the inside of its seed is the point where life pivots and starts to move from the dark absolute to the bright relative, or from formlessness to form. If you study the 12-fold chain of causation, from the point of view of human life and the human mind, this first movement or pivot is called ignorance. It's kind of a forgetting of where we come from. But the pivot also goes the other way so we can learn it again. The root reminds me that despite my forgetting, my life is rooted in the source of being. So the root of my life gives me a way home. The first stem that emerges from the root immediately travels upward, seeking the light, energy from the sun. That stem is hollow and transports sap from the root to the emerging leaf, Later, it circulates energy back to the root for storage and growing new stems. Lotus stems are very thick, prickly, and tough. If you try to pick a blossom by snapping it off, you can't do it. Because when you pull on the stem, the whole plant comes up, roots, everything. It doesn't want to be separated. Fibers from lotus stems are sometimes collected, hand-spun, and woven into cloth used to make Buddhist robes for revered teachers. And now there's new interest in that kind of lotus cloth as a highly sustainable eco-textile. To keep a straight posture in Zazen, I sometimes imagine my back, which I'm not sitting very well right now, but my back as a tall, sturdy lotus stem, circulating energy in my body from my root. Susan Piver, a meditation teacher in a Tibetan lineage, suggests that imagining the energy in our body below the waist as moving downward to the earth and the energy in our upper body moving upward to the sky. I really enjoy that. It seems we can reenact that intimate connection between darkness and light, earth and sky, and root and blossom when we do Zazen. When the lotus stem emerges from the mud, it encounters muddy water. So mud is our original ground of being, but when the human mind stirs up the water of life, it picks up the mud and the human world becomes murky. We can't see things clearly, so our actions end up causing suffering for ourselves and others. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, has the book No Mud, No Lotus, The Art of Transforming Suffering. Now you can buy inspirational jewelry and t-shirts with the slogan, No Mud, No Lotus. I think it's a pretty good slogan. I haven't actually read the book, but I learned that he sees the muddy water of suffering as an opportunity for human beings, because suffering gives us the idea of breaking free and the willingness then to follow a spiritual path to help us do that. From that point of view, we can have gratitude for difficulties because they teach us the most. Zen Master Dogen takes this a little deeper. In Shobo Genzo Uji, Being Time, he has the term going into mud and water. It means we can realize freedom right in the middle of the world of delusion, because freedom is already present within us as our Buddha nature. So bodhisattvas can accept life in the muddy water as an opportunity to develop ourselves and help others who are there with us and suffering. I have a hard time with this embrace of suffering, but I know it's a true practice. The goal is not to escape. It's to not stir things up in the first place. Or to accept suffering as it is and then let the muddy water settle so that we can see things better and know what to do. So then, emerging from the muddy water is a leaf. A lotus leaf may float on the surface of the water, or it may stand high above the water. Either way, its main job is to bask in the sun and to breathe. And while it's doing that, photosynthesis is going on within its cells, its body. Leaves breathe by absorbing carbon dioxide in the air through small pores and then releasing oxygen as a byproduct of photosynthesis. It's kind of the opposite of what we're doing. and works together with what we do. The lotus leaf has a high concentration of pores on its upper surface because it's an aquatic plant. And they need to be open for it to breathe. So drops of water sitting on the surface of the leaf would block those pores. So to cope with that, the lotus has a very rare characteristic, which is called ultrahydrophobicity. Botanically, this is known as the lotus effect. There's a dense surface layer of waxy tubules in the structure of the leaf that have the effect of reducing the area of contact between drops of water and the leaf to a minuscule point. Then, with even the slightest movement of the leaf, like a fish swimming by and rippling the water or a breeze blowing, the drops roll right off. All the parts of the lotus plant have this waxy surface, and it's the source of the renowned purity of the lotus. And it's a perfect model for non-attachment. The lotus just basks in the sun's energy, breathing, receiving nourishment from the root and through the long umbilical cord of the stem, and letting anything that attaches itself to it go. What a fabulous image for understanding Sazen as just sitting Shikantaza. The leaf has no goal other than to just be present and allow its life to function. Just doing that is the meaning of life for a leaf. One more thing about the leaf is that the lotus is a primitive plant. Every stem ends with either one leaf or one blossom. It means that the leaf can't create a blossom directly. One of the principles of Zazen practice is that we don't aim at a certain outcome. We aren't trying to experience enlightenment. We just sit. It seems passive, but it puts us right in the middle of something that's bigger, much bigger than our own ideas of who we are or of what we want. I've come to really love the image of the lotus leaf floating on the surface of the muddy water and letting everything roll off. It gives me a clear sense of what to do in Zazen and in other situations too. We aren't a site for photosynthesis, but we can just bask in our life energy. We can breathe and depend on our rootedness to the earth. Just be present with the physical functioning of our existence in the context of the functioning of the whole of existence. The lotus flower is universally recognized as something beautiful. In Buddhism, that beauty symbolizes spiritual enlightenment. Enlightenment shows us the sublime beauty of human life. And that beauty is called Buddha nature, or just Buddha. That beauty is present in all beings because everything has Buddha nature. This is the message of the Lotus Sutra, which is what has made it such an influential Mahayana scripture. Believing that Buddhahood is open to everyone offers hope that by living in a certain way, we can realize life as something beautiful. But when you consider the lotus blossom botanically, beauty isn't a symbol, it's a tactic. The lotus does not have nectar, so it needs another way to attract the beetles that pollinate it. Size and color are one way. But here the lotus gets very interesting, because the blossom itself has another extremely rare characteristic: thermoregulation. The flower can heat itself. It can regulate its temperature to maintain a constant temperature like a bird or a mammal. It can maintain an 86 to 95 degree range of temperature even in 50 degree weather. In other words, it has a warm heart. The lotus blooms for 4 days. On the first day, it partially opens, barely exposing the immature seed pod, which is technically a fruit, in its center. And it turns up the heat. The heat intensifies a fragrance that the flower has, and that attracts beetles. They arrive carrying pollen from other plants that they've already visited, and that's needed to cross-fertilize with this plant. So with the beetles on board and ready to pollinate, at dusk, the petals close up, and they enclose the cold-blooded beetles and give them a warm shelter for the night, or maybe trap them. On the second day, the petals open completely at dawn. At that same time, the blossom's own pollen now becomes ripe. This prevents it from fertilizing itself. And it's ready for the overnighting beetles to pick up that pollen on their body and carry it to another plant. After that, the blossom opens and closes again for 2 more days, giving a warm night refuge to beetles and giving away its pollen. On the 4th day, the petals fall off, leaving the pod as a standalone womb holding the growing seeds. Eventually, the pod rots and the seeds sink into the bottom mud, ready to produce the next generation. For me, the lotus's blooming pattern is an opportunity to think about how we balance caring for ourselves and caring for others. The lotus has a warm heart. It invites beetles, feeds them, and provides a warm refuge. But it does this for its own benefit first. It serves the needs of other plants only after its own needs have been met. I think it's a good reminder that as bodhisattvas, it's okay to take care of ourselves first as a primary condition for being able to help others. Though in the murky water of everyday life in the human world, it's always hard to figure out how to get that balance right. So now we've covered the whole life cycle of the lotus. To wrap up, I just want to say that after studying and reflecting on these different aspects of the plant, I can say that the lotus has brought something warm and positive to my Zen practice, and I really, really value it and appreciate it. Like you, I already knew that the beauty of the lotus symbolizes the purity of an enlightened mind arising in the muddy waters of samsara. But I found so many more reasons to love and honor the lotus as a worthy companion on the Buddhist path. And I'm really glad for the chance to tell you about it. So I have these two photos of the lotuses at the statues at Taizawin. If you'd like to see a real lotus blooming, or growing, depending, you can sometimes see one at the Como Park. Park Conservatory in St. Paul. They had one, I think, a couple of years ago, but I didn't see one there this year. But even better is the Wat Munisotaram Cambodian Buddhist Temple in Hampton, Minnesota. It has a lush lotus pond on its grounds. That's a Theravadin temple. It's 35 miles south of Zen Center and about a 45-minute drive. And it's a wonderful place to visit, and you'll see so many statues of lotuses that it will blow your mind. Yeah, so that's what I have for you today. Do you have anything you'd like to ask me or tell about yourself? Yes. Oh gosh, thanks so much.
For your work and research and sharing.
Well, it was truly my pleasure. Yeah, thanks. You're welcome. Hey.
I just want to also just say thank you. I just, for to hear your talk, it just, again, nature is our greatest teacher. And I always find inspiration and help in observing and watching nature. And so I really, really enjoyed your talk. In herbalism, you know, we always have our ally plants. And I just appreciate that. Something that really speaks to you, and just thank you.
I really feel like it's something we all share because it represents the, our path and our goal and our life. So it's just nice to just remember it and take care of it. Thank you.
Hey. I didn't quite tell with your description if the lotus itself grow, well, I'm wondering how it responds to water level changes. If it sometimes grows out of the water on its own, or if that's from the water changing. If you found that,
I think it just has this growth habit. The stalks or stems that the leaves grow on, it's their way to grow to 6 feet. So I think it's just going to grow to 6 feet. I guess if it didn't have proper nutrition, it might not be able to make that kind of growth. And then the stems with the blossoms grow to 6.5 feet, so they're always taller than the foliage. But what I meant to say was that you won't see it at 6.5 feet. It won't seem that tall to you because some of that height is taken up by what's underwater. And some of them, I don't know why some of them float and some of them don't. I guess there has to be some space available for them to occupy to float. But I got attached, or I shouldn't say attached, but I got interested in the floating image most because it resonated with me in terms of Zazen practice.
So they're not really growing in water that is changing levels a lot.
As far as I know, not too much, but right, things change. Drought or torrents or whatever, things can happen. So some of the stems, if it's floating, probably some of the stems aren't going straight. They're bent underwater. Yeah. Hi.
Thank you for your talk.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thank you especially for the phrase, the womb of Buddha, because the Buddha's womb was like the womb of all of us. It was our mother's womb. And the ovum that was in our mother was a product of all of the food and nutrition and the air and the water that she was taking in while that ovum grew and developed, and the same with the sperm from my father. And when the two were united, my mother continued to take in matter and energy from the earth. So the Buddha's womb is really the womb of the earth itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
at some point, the miracle of the fact that we are conscious occurs. And our consciousness is rooted in these material bodies. And we somehow or another miss the fact that our bodies are just fragments of the earth walking around on its surface. And we imagine that we are independent. And from this sense of independence rises greed, anger, delusion, and the problematic situation in which we now find ourselves. So thank you.
Yes, all true. Thank you. All right, well, thank... Oh, no, one more. Yes.
The most inspiring image that you gave was of the 1,200 years of patience. So knowing that, I can calm down.
Be patient. Okay, yes.